Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way, who discusses how the outcome of this year's presidential election will influence future decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. Bridget Flaherty, an organizer with the grassroots group GOP Hands Off Me, who explains why women have risen up to demand the Republican Party withdraw its endorsement of presidential candidate Donald Trump. And Roger Salazar of California's Yes on 61 campaign, who talks about the fight being waged to win a ballot measure this November that would require state agencies to pay the same low prices for prescription drugs as paid by the Veterans Administration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The African nation of Kenya is moving quickly to empty out the massive Dadaab refugee camp, home to over 300,000 refugees from Somalia, by the end of November. According to Foreign Policy magazine, there are charges that Kenyan troops are carrying out forced evictions. Over the last 2 years, more than 28,000 refugees have returned to Somalia under United Nations direction. The returnees must then compete with 1 million other displaced persons in Somalia, still in the midst of a civil war, which has created harsh living conditions. The refugees are returned to places like Kismayo, where the city's mayor, Ibrahim Mohamed Yusuf, explained, "People are being dumped here with no international support. There are no shelters, no food, no health care, and no schools. We are a small country reeling from civil war. How can we be expected to care for more people?" Advocates for refugees and aid workers want to halt the massive repatriation, which is bankrolled by the U.S. government. Doctors Without Borders has proposed setting up a series of smaller camps in Kenya to replace the Dadaab camp, which first opened in the early 1990s. Doctors Without Borders Kenya director Lisbeth Eilbrecht lamented, "Thousands are essentially being pushed back into conflict and acute crisis, the very conditions they fled." The epicenter in America's debate over money in politics is now being fought in South Dakota, a rural state with less than 1 million people. Its voters will decide the fate of Measure 22, a ballot initiative that would establish a system of public financing for candidates, create a state ethics commission, and ban legislators from accepting gifts from lobbyists. The fight over Measure 22 also pits two sets of out-of-state megadonors against each other in a state that has not seen many big corruption scandals. Measure 22 is backed by the Massachusetts-based reform group Represent Us, which is bankrolled by several Silicon Valley tech titans. Opposition to Measure 22 is organized by the Tea Party-affiliated Americans for Prosperity, funded by the billionaire Koch brothers, and supported by other right-wing activist groups. South Dakota, with its populist heritage, has a long history of direct democracy dating back to 1898 and has been a testing ground for debating national issues. On this fall's ballot, South Dakota citizens will vote on 10 questions, half of them financed by wealthy out-of-state donors. The New Hampshire Firearms Safety Coalition, founded by gun store owner Ralph D'Amico, advocates for the safe storage of guns and for providing aid to gun owners in emotional distress in an effort to prevent suicides. Nationally, over 400 people a week commit suicide using a gun. In 2010, the New Hampshire Coalition began distributing pamphlets and posters on suicide prevention to gun stores. The group took a harm reduction approach, similar to campaigns on drug addiction. Harvard University public health researcher Catherine Barber, who advises gun safety groups, told the Christian Science Monitor, "It makes sense to work within the culture of gun-owning groups." D'Amico got involved in gun safety work after he was told by Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital that 3 people had committed suicide within a week of legally purchasing a gun at his store. Even as the homicide rate has fallen since 2000, the suicide rate has increased dramatically across America. Nationally, men are now 4 times as likely to use a gun to commit suicide as women. In 2014, the U.S. government documented over 21,000 suicides using a gun. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After saturation media coverage of Donald Trump's insults and personal attacks, as well as daily focus on Hillary Clinton's email server and leaked campaign emails, there are a host of critical issues that haven't received the attention they deserve in the 2016 election campaign. One of those issues is how the outcome of this November's presidential election will influence future decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. After the death of the Supreme Court's staunchest conservative and longest-serving justice, Antonin Scalia, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asserted that the nomination of a replacement should wait until after the November 2016 election. However, in March, President Obama, following the U.S. Constitution, nominated Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, to fill the vacancy. As promised, the GOP-controlled Senate has blocked a vote on Garland's nomination, resulting in several 4-4 ties between the conservative and liberal wings of the court on key cases, with the likelihood that several elderly justices may retire in the near future. The next president could appoint as many as 4 new members of the court. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, executive vice president with the group People for the American Way, who discusses what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have said about what would guide their selection of future nominees to the court and the critical issues at stake.
Just about every issue the American public cares about deeply is affected by the Supreme Court. So if you care about being able to have reasonable regulations of rules around campaign finance, if you care about the environment, if you care about voting rights, if you care about women's rights, if you care about choice, if you care about LGBT equality, if you care about workers' rights to organize, if you care about immigrants' rights, every single one of those is affected by who sits on the court and the balance on the Supreme Court. What we have now is a court that essentially is tied 4-4 and is paralyzed in many cases from making decisions. For example, in the recent case involving the president's executive actions on immigration. So there's a huge, huge amount at stake in this election around who sits on the court, not just in terms of whether we continue to have the vacancy that Merrick Garland's been nominated to remain empty, which remains to be seen. But because there are at least 3 more justices who, during the course of this next presidency, will be more than 80 years old, and the average retirement age for justices is less than that. So the future of the court for generation is at stake in this election, which is why it's so critical and we've been working so hard.
Marge, can you describe for our listeners the relative positions of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as relates to the Supreme Court and what their plan would be?
Secretary Clinton has articulated a standard for the kinds of justices that she would look for, and she said that she wants justices to respect the Constitution that's there for all Americans, not just the powerful and the privileged. And she's been clear about issues such as choice and campaign finance rules, reasonable campaign finance rules, and LGBT equality, and any number of workers' rights, any number of issues. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has basically said he's going to outsource the selection of his nominees to a very, very conservative Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, and he's given us a list of justices that he would nominate to the bench if he were elected, that is truly frightening. One of the justices on his list believes that Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, child labor laws, disaster relief, food safety laws, and the Violence Against Women Act are all unconstitutional. And another called the Roe v. Wade decision the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history. So the choices could not be more stark. between these two candidates. And what we've been trying to emphasize as we talk to voters is, you know, there's a binary choice here. It's going to be either Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump who are going to be president, and they will have the ability to choose to replace three, potentially four justices on the Supreme Court. And so it matters. It absolutely matters in the presidential election who you vote for. And frankly, it also matters in terms of the Senate, because we've seen what a GOP-controlled Senate will do in terms of ignoring its constitutional responsibility to give the nominee fair consideration. So if the Senate remains in Republican hands and Secretary Clinton is elected president, she's still going to have trouble getting her nominees through. So we absolutely, in our view, have to have a Democratic-controlled Senate in order to make sure that the nominees that Secretary Clinton puts forward, if she's elected president, will actually be given fair consideration.
There are many disgruntled progressive activists who basically want to opt out of this election,
mm-hmm.
not happy with the choices of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And you often hear them say, you know, it doesn't really matter. If I sit out the election or I vote for a third party candidate, what's the difference? It's all going to be horrible anyway.
Yeah.
You know, kind of just very cynical. And you know, who can blame people for having that attitude? But when you get to the real world, and we've been talking about it tonight, there are some fundamental choices that will be made by the next president as regards to the Supreme Court that will affect people in this country for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ahead. What's your best argument that you make for people not to sit out this election, even if they are convinced that they are voting for the lesser of two evils?
Yeah, this is a unique moment in history where we have an opportunity to rebalance the court and have it and rebalance it in favor of the American people as opposed to sort of wealthy, powerful special interests. And kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that moment. And it is a choice that voters will make that affect not just the next 4 years, but generations, the next 40 years or more. And so there's a stark choice to be made here. And if there were a single reason for someone who, and I totally understand people who are, you know, disenchanted with the choices, but if there is a reason to go out and vote, there is a huge choice here, and it's going to be either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton who's going to be selecting up to three or four justices on the Supreme Court who serve for life and therefore will be there for generations. And it is a critical, critical opportunity, and kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way. Find more analysis and commentary on the 2016 election and future of the Supreme Court by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The political environment in the U.S. presidential election campaign began shifting after the release of a video recording in which Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump bragged about sexually assaulting women. He said, "When you're a celebrity, they let you do it." The video clip, where Trump boasted about kissing, groping, and attempting to have sex with women, was recorded in a 2005 conversation with Access Hollywood TV show host Billy Bush, which was captured on a live microphone. Since the release of the tape, more than 10 women have publicly accused Trump of engaging in harassment and sexual assault over the last decade or more. Some Republican elected officials who had endorsed Trump disavowed him, while many others have maintained their support for his candidacy. Accusations that he had harassed mostly white women brought the issue closer to home for many white politicians, who could imagine their wives or daughters being similarly assaulted. First Lady Michelle Obama's heartfelt, unscripted 9-minute speech about Trump's behavior went viral, in which she said the men in her life and the men in millions of other women's lives don't engage in the kind of so-called locker room banter that Trump alleged this was. Another response to the scandal was a grassroots uprising of women who organized protests on October 18th in 15 cities under the slogan GOP Hands Off Me. They excoriated Trump and demanded that the Republican Party withdraw their endorsement of the real estate billionaire. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with one of the action's organizers, Bridget Flaherty, who explained how the simultaneous demonstrations were organized and their plan of action after the November 8th election.
This really is a grassroots organic response, definitely prompted by the Trump tapes being released. But also, I think women who have just been outraged since the first time Trump made an outrageously racist and sexist comment, which was all Mexicans are racist, right? For some time now, for his entire run for presidency, there has been anger brewing and a fight back brewing of women across all races. And I think the Trump tapes just became that spark that ignited women taking to the streets and really saying that we are not going to stand for a president, but also a system that is building its power and policy off of racism and sexism. You know, it was definitely this moment when a couple of friends got on the phone and said, we have to respond and we have to get out there and really show that there is a multiracial feminist movement that is emerging and growing and really taking its power from the other organizing that has happened before, particularly with women of color in racial justice spaces, Black Lives Matter, Mi Gente.
But you're not just focusing on Trump, right?
GOP Hands Off Me is really an expression of rage against the entire Republican Party. All of their electeds who basically made Trump, right? The Trump is created by the Republican Party. It's been created by, like I was saying, their policies and practices over so many years of misogyny and racism and anti-immigrant hatred. And that's why we're really directing it at Trump, but also directing it at the Republican Party because of their role and the responsibility they have in this moment, creating this man who literally embodies everything terrible about this system.
Bridget Flaherty, tell us what happened across the country when women came out for these actions.
On October 18th, thousands of women across the country did GOP Hands Off Me actions in 15 cities. You saw them in smaller places like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and then you had New York City, Miami, Philly, D.C., Oakland, Denver. Thousands of women taking to the streets, multiracial feminist wave of action demanding the GOP take their hands off them and create a world that values women, women of color, immigrants, trans and queer folks.
When you focus on criticizing the Republican Party, does your movement take any position on the election or on the Democratic Party?
You know, I like to say that rape culture is a bipartisan problem. This is not something that is unique to the Republican Party, and we know that Democrats have also been complicit in creating a culture that doesn't respect women and have created policies that particularly have hurt women of color and immigrants. But for right now, we are very focused on ending the reign, the racist and sexist reign of the Republican Party and making sure Trump doesn't get in office. But you can believe that when anybody gets into office, whether at the state level, the federal level, or president after November 8th, that there is a movement of women that will hold them accountable to creating a world that values women of color, that values immigrants, that values queer and trans folks. And that's what we're going to be doing post-November 8th.
You said it was very grassroots and individuals got together. Is there any organization that contributed to making this happen?
I would say that, I mean, individuals, the women who got on the phone that Friday night, we come out of a tradition of organizing. We all have been organizing for many years. We created a container for women to come in and heal in a space and be seen by each other, but also express their rage. And that is truly, it is a grassroots movement.
That was Bridget Flaherty, an organizer with a grassroots group, GOP Hands Off Me. For more information on the group and their protest actions, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. California, which has a long tradition of empowering voters to decide critical public policy issues, will have 17 statewide referendum questions on the ballot this November. Among those ballot measures are proposals to repeal the state's death penalty, legalize marijuana for recreational use, and requiring actors use condoms during the filming of pornographic films. However, Proposition 61, one of the referendum questions before voters this November, has attracted the most money contributed by donors to defeat the measure. Prop 61 would regulate drug prices by requiring state agencies to pay the same prices for prescription drugs that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs pays. The VA negotiates drug prices with pharmaceutical companies, paying on average 25% less for drugs than other government agencies. Supporters of the measure say that if approved, the new regulation could save California taxpayers an estimated $5.7 billion over the next 10 years. Opponents warn that if Proposition 61 is implemented, it would only assist the state's poor, increase prices for veterans, and reduce access to some medicines. Thus far, pharmaceutical companies have contributed most of the $108 million to defeat Proposition 61. The AIDS Healthcare Foundation, one of the initiators of the ballot question, has spent about $14 million to support it. Your reporter spoke with Roger Salazar, a spokesperson for the Yes on 61 campaign, who explains the purpose and benefit of Proposition 61 for California citizens, its power as an example for other states around the country, and threat to drug company monopoly pricing.
Basically, what the California Drug Price Relief Act, or Proposition 61, would do is it would require the state of California to negotiate with drug companies for drug prices that are no more than is paid for the same drugs by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The Department of Veterans Affairs pays the lowest price of any federal agency, and so what this measure would do would empower the state as the healthcare buyer for millions of Californians to negotiate that same or even better deal for taxpayers. And right now, the state of California spends about $4 billion a year in prescription drugs that it is responsible for purchasing. The Department of Veterans Affairs gets anywhere from a 24%, up to 40% in some cases, but at least an average of 24% less for medications than other government agencies do. So we kind of extrapolated from that if the state of California were to get the same deal that the Department of Veterans Affairs gets, it would save the state about $1 billion a year. Healthcare costs, are sharply increasing. Drug prices are now the fastest growing cost component of healthcare costs. The drug prices continue to skyrocket, and what we've seen lately is drug companies are raising their prices at will, even on decades-old drugs, whose creation has been paid for many times over. So, they continue to prioritize profits over saving lives, and from our perspective, we felt there was a strong need to take a stand against the price gouging that's been going on and let the pharmaceutical industry know that Californians aren't going to stand for it anymore.
Roger, tell our listeners who's lined up for and against Proposition 61 in California, including prominent politicians and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders and his new organization, Our Revolution, has come out in support of Proposition 61. We have the California Nurses Association and National Nurses United. We have AARP, the largest, obviously, group of senior consumer advocates that are supporting us, as well as Social Security Works, California State Retirees, and the California Alliance for Retired Americans. We have the Urban League. We have Dolores Huerta, who is one of the founders of the United Farm Workers movement here in California, as well as most of the local Democratic organizations, Democratic Party organizations in California. A lot of the folks that we have seen line up on the no side, who have lined up in opposition to this measure, have some sort of financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. So, whether it's the California Medical Association or any number of these other groups who have lined up with the pharmaceutical industry, they've all got some sort of interest with the pharmaceutical industry. The only folks that we're really that we're really sort of perplexed about and it bothers us is that the no side was able to scare some of the veterans groups into opposing this measure. We do have Vote Vets supporting our side of the measure, but they basically have tried to frighten the veterans into thinking that this measure somehow would impact the prices that are paid by the Department of Veterans Affairs, when actually those prices are protected by statute. So it's a really sort of a sad state that they're using veterans to try and make their case.
What's at stake for the big pharma companies if it does pass November 8th, Proposition 61? Is this kind of referendum or law likely to spread around the country? How much interest has your group received in trying to figure out how a similar law could be proposed and approved in their state all across the country? Have you gotten a lot of inquiries about that?
We have, and in fact, there are a couple of places like Illinois and Ohio which are looking at these measures as well. And the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is the principal sponsor of this measure, has an active presence in some of those states and are looking at putting something on the ballot in other states as well. But let me just sort of go back. It's funny because the no side, whenever they talk about this measure with their campaigns, they try to use scare tactics and fear mongering to sort of try and scare people into voting against this. But when they talk to themselves, they tell you exactly what's at stake. And I'm going to read something to you from the Pharmaceutical Executive magazine, pharmaexec.com, in which they call Proposition 61 ground zero for American prescription price controls. They say basically that the question is really, what would price controls look like if they took hold in the United States? They answer that by saying it can be summed up in one word, California, because the state of California, they say, is now poised to serve as ground zero in the massive battle that will ultimately determine whether or not prescription price controls will be implemented anytime soon in California. And they say, here's the point, that if the voters of California approve Proposition 61, it would establish an incredibly deep mandatory discount, in essence a price control, for the public purchase of prescription drugs in America's largest state. And this is what they really fear. They say that such an action would no doubt cause an immediate demand for the same VA discount rate to be made available to other states, the federal government, and likely private entities as well. So in short, they say that adoption of a VA pricing system by the state of California would be a pricing disaster for the entire U.S. drug industry. So this is what they fear most. They recognize that this is going to push down drug prices. They recognize that this is going to cut into their massive, massive profits, and that's why they're spending so much money to try to defeat it.
That was Roger Salazar, a spokesperson for California's Yes on 61 campaign. Learn more about the Proposition 61 ballot question by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.